happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Berlindy, the founder and editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. I suppose 2020 is a bit of a big anniversary for us here at the Fretboard Journal. For 15 years, we have been doing the Fretboard Journal magazine. If you've never seen it, it is a collectible coffee table book style magazine, unlike any other guitar magazine you've ever seen. And we really, really, really work hard to find interviews and photo essays and histories that you are not going to find anywhere else. If you love our podcast, if you love the videos that we put out, including the video we just put out with Christopher Paul Stelling, who is this week's guest, the easiest way to support this show is to just get a digital subscription to the Fretboard Journal magazine. I am currently throwing in two issues, Fretboard Journal 44 and the new Fretboard Journal 45, with any four-issue subscription. So you get six issues for the price of four. And the coolest part of all, besides these being in digital form and PDF that you can look at on any device, is that it's only $30. So for the equivalent of $2.50 a month, you'll be supporting this weekly podcast, all the interviews that we do, all the cool stuff, and you'll get to see what all the fuss is about with this magazine that we've been putting out for 15 years. I can't thank you all enough for supporting the show by joining us. To all the folks who are existing subscribers, we owe you big time. Thank you for letting us do this unique, eccentric, quirky magazine that barely has any advertising and has so many cool artists and luthiers in it. I'm going to include a link in the show notes to that digital subscription in case anybody wants to join us. And like I said, you will get six issues for the price of four, including our brand new 45th issue, which has Colin Malloy of the Decemberists on the cover, and Eric Sky and Ken Hooper, and all of these amazing, incredible figures that you often hear about on this very podcast. So the podcast this week is a unique one. Christopher Paul Stelling, don't want to screw that name up, just released a record called Best of Luck that was produced by Ben Harper. Now, we know Ben. He's been on this show. He's been in our magazine. I consider him a friend. Pretty much everything he touches, I'm going to give a listen to because I know it's going to be pretty good. I was floored by this record. If you have not heard this record, go to your streaming service of choice. Check it out. Again, it's Christopher Paul Stelling, Best of Luck. It is truly one of my favorite records of the last few years. I was super excited to talk to him. We actually do already have a feature scheduled in the Fretboard Journal 46 on Christopher as well. But I got to be honest, I didn't know this guy. We had never corresponded before he came to our office, and I didn't really know what to expect. I just read the little interviews that I could find online and did my 10 minutes of preparation, as I always do. What I didn't expect was such a funny, hilarious, insightful guy, somebody who I think of now as a friend. We've been texting back and forth. I think you'll think of him as a friend after you hear this podcast because he has so many cool things to say. I left this interview in its entirety intact, so if you don't want to hear us rambling about mushrooms, no, not those kind of mushrooms, you can skip ahead 90 seconds, but I just wanted to give the full arc of this interview because it was so much fun to meet someone for the first time and talk about guitars. We cover a lot of ground, from the lawnmower job he had when he was a kid so that he could afford a guitar, to dabbling in luthery Rhono mandolins. I had no idea that he was working for that guy. Really fun interview. I think you're going to love it. And of course, we do talk about the 50s Marden 0017 that he had for the video shoot he did with us, as well as that nylon string guitar, which I'm sure you've seen him use in a bunch of videos. Christopher Paul Stelling, coolest guy around. I think you will agree. One of the most fun interviews we've done on this podcast ever. We also have been on a little bit of a roll lately. If you didn't go back and listen to that Jim Campolongo podcast we did a week ago, by all means, check that out. We had Dan Erlewine on this show recently, TJ Thompson on the show. So many fun interviews. I'm going to be interviewing Trey Burt in a week or two, which, again, another amazing singer-songwriter who just put out a record that's blown me away. So subscribe to this podcast. It's free. You'll get it every week. We, of course, have other podcasts as well in our family, Luthier on Luthier, The Truth About Vintage Amps. We're working our butts off over here in Seattle, trying to generate as much cool guitar content as possible with our tiny little team. So again, we'd appreciate it if you would support us by getting a digital subscription, or if you want to go all out, get a print subscription. They are the coolest thing that I ever have done in my life. Again, Fretboard Journal 45 is out now. We did a little event called the Fretboard Summit 5 years ago and 4 years ago. We're bringing it back August 21st and August 22nd. We're moving it to Chicago. So if anybody wants to be a part of the coolest guitar gathering you will ever attend, reach out to me, podcast@fretboardjournal.com, and we can add you to the wait list for the registration link when that goes live. It's basically going to be a little bit of a music festival, a little bit of TED Talks, a lot of the faces and voices that you've heard on the Fretboard Journal podcast and in our magazine coming together. When we did these things in the past, they were absolutely magical. And I figured it's our 15th anniversary. It's time to bring it back. So we are booking it right now as I speak. It's going to be an amazing lineup of folks, both during the daytime and during the evening. And I would love to see as many Fretboard Journal readers and podcast listeners there as humanly possible. So stay tuned for that. You will be getting all sorts of notices about that if you follow us on our Instagram page. Before we get to the interview with Christopher, shout outs to a couple of our sponsors, Mono Cases. They've been sponsoring everything that we do, including the magazine, even the mailers that our magazine goes in so that they don't get dinged up by your local post person. Sponsored by Mono. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags and pedal boards and pedal board bags and backpacks and everything that they do. Everything that they have put out that I have seen has been top-notch, bulletproof, incredible quality. I have a parts caster that I absolutely adore. I have been taking it everywhere in my Mono Vertigo bag. We've had torrential rains here in Seattle, puddles everywhere. This thing's got like the sole of a rubber boot on the bottom of it so that you could put your guitar down. I don't recommend this, but you could put your guitar down in a puddle. Guitar's going to stay dry. Case is going to do its job. Go to monocreators.com, see their entire lineup of everything that they do. Also have to give a shout out to our friends over in New York City at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. I say this every week, and every week they never disappoint. They have the most eclectic, interesting lineup of inventory I've seen in any guitar store anywhere. And the hits keep coming. I don't know where they find all this stuff. The other cool thing I want to say about Retrofret is they have things like a 59 Sunburst Jazzmaster with the gold pickguard. Just came in, if anybody's looking for one. They have the collector grade stuff, but then they also get things like a solid body Burns short scale jazz guitar from 1963 that's $850. They get silver tones, they get harmonies, they get so many interesting guitars. Their descriptions are also probably the most insightful out of any dealer description that I have found, especially in the world of electric guitars, where those tend to be a little slim at some of these stores. Go to retrofret.com, see their inventory. They always have the gold standards from Martin and Gibson as well. I always just feature the weird stuff, which I probably shouldn't do, but they've never told me not to. So go to retrofret.com, see all that they have. An Ampeg AMUB1 bass with the F holes that go all the way through the body, as well as like the slot head headstock that was owned by Walter Becker of Steely Dan. Man, I don't know where they get that. Well, I know where they got that. They got that at the Walter Becker auction, but I don't know where they get any of this other stuff. So go to retrofret.com, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. I am rambling. You're about to hear some more rambling from Christopher, Paul, Stelling, and I, but I hope you enjoy it. As always, if you enjoy this podcast, support us. I've given you some options, and share it with friends. let people know, go on social media, tell folks that this podcast exists and that you love it. Again, Christopher Paul Stelling, Best of Luck is the album. It's on Anti Records. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, I can
agree. Now we'll ruin it.
Okay. But yeah, I don't know. Lots of podcasts. Lots of talking podcasts. I think it's like a song is a universe. I can't recreate.
Well, if you're on the road too, I find that like the interaction of a podcast or just feeling like you're connecting with someone, it keeps you a little more alert or engaged.
Right.
A slow song can have you drive off a cliff.
Like, yes.
And the middle of the night.
But it's just that, like, you know, 30 minutes goes by and you listen to one of the most epic records possibly of all time.
Yeah.
And it's only been 30 minutes.
Yeah.
We're one of these podcasts, you know, like if you need to kill a 6-hour drive.
Oh yeah. Joe Rogan.
Yeah. Or Mark, yeah. Especially Mark.
Yeah.
I just started with the Rogan only cause I ran out of Mark, and I'm surprised he's into some stuff I'm into.
Mm-hmm.
He's into, you know, some fringe, weirdo stuff.
Oh, let's hear it.
Oh no, let's not get too weird.
Oh, come on.
He just likes to talk about the mind and psychedelics and,
yeah,
you know, all sorts of, not that I'm like an avid, psychedelic, user, you know what I mean? But I'm just like,
it's fascinating.
Consciousness is interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And music and its effect on consciousness. Like, yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. I think he's actually interviewing him today.
Mm-hmm.
This guy who's sort of local, he's like 2 hours away, but he's in Washington State, Paul Stamets, who's like the mushroom guru.
Oh yeah.
All kinds of mushrooms, the edible, the hallucinogenic.
Mm.
And
mushrooms are really fascinating, like the mycelia and how it,
oh yeah,
it spreads. There's out a whole miles movie. And miles.
There's a whole movie that this guy's kind of starring in that just came out.
Oh wow.
But yeah, it was a pretty amazing interview because for 2 hours they talk about mushrooms. We'll eventually start talking about guitars, I should preface. But for 2 hours, they're talking about mushrooms.
I'd argue there never would have been a guitar had there not been mushrooms first.
And then midway through, Joe Rogan kind of casually asked, hey, we haven't talked about portobellos.
Hmm.
And this guy was like, I don't want to talk about portobellos.
Oh, he's
and
done
basically
with portobellos.
Made it sound like big mushroom. Like we should not be eating portobello, reading between the lines.
Only because there's no, probably no medicinal quality. Maybe it's like,
I think they're bad for us. He sort of just said like, all I'm going to tell everyone is, make sure they're cooked really well.
That's cryptic.
It was extremely cryptic and a little disturbing. And I have to say, I heard that a year ago and I haven't had a single portobello mushroom since.
I mean, I marinate that thing in olive oil, salt and pepper, little soy sauce, throw it on the grill.
Better watch yourself.
I like to let it go. I like to let it sit on there for a minute.
All right.
Portobello on the grill is
it's good.
Next best thing to a 50s Martin or something. I mean, you know.
So speaking of which, Martin. We're staring at this Martin. What?
Yeah.
When did you get this thing?
Oh, I don't know. It was maybe like 5 years ago, and I was so afraid of it like you had mentioned my Gibson C1.
You have a classical guitar that is almost on the Glenn Hansard level of, you know, his Takamine that's like,
yeah,
you can see through or trigger.
Yeah, it was, I traded in a distortion pedal for that guitar.
Okay.
At the Guitar Trader in Asheville, North Carolina, many years ago, maybe like 2005 or 6 or something like that. And I took that guitar to New York and kind of, that was it.
Yeah.
I left Asheville and I had, you know, broke up with somebody I was dating. I wound up in New York City because there was a friend whose place I could stay at.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up living in a little basement that flooded and we were walking around on cinder blocks and boards and started playing open mics. And eventually there was something really freeing about New York where it's like this sense of anonymity. Like I could just do anything and nobody would know.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would care, more importantly.
Sure.
And then, yeah, one thing led to another and here I am like many years later and music is what I've been doing.
Was there a break when you were in New York where you like turned a corner from the open mic and something happened?
Yeah, I got put on a bill at the Mercury Lounge. I was doing like open mics, my friend Niall Connolly runs an open mic, and he was the first person to like invite me to be a feature on an open mic.
Okay.
There's this guy, Brendan O'Shea, the Irish.
Yeah.
The Irish took to me, you know, okay. like Irish immigrant singer songwriters kind of took to me. And these guys are probably, I think Niall and Brendan are both, you mentioned Glenn. I think they're both friends with Glenn and that whole like crew. And, yeah, so got to be a feature on a couple open mics, and then got asked to do a show at like Mercury Lounge with a friend of mine named Chris, whose name is Christopher.
Okay.
And I think what happened was that at the end of the night, they handed me like $300. I think what had been happening is there were two Chris's on the bill, and I think I got all the checks as people walked through the door, and they forgot to put the other Chris. So when they pulled the money at the end between the three acts,
yeah,
I got like two.
Got it.
Two of our money.
Yeah.
I just realized that years later, and they handed me $300, and I said, "Oh Jesus, this is."
Yeah.
I think I made it. Like, this is it.
Yeah.
Like, this is it. I had been working 40 hours a week at a you know, in a kitchen, to make way less than that.
Yeah.
So this was a revelation that you could play gigs and get paid.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one thing led to another. And then there's, you know, I'd fast forward a couple of years and I'm going on tours that are like 100 shows long.
Yeah. That's wild.
Just to facilitate, you know, I've done a lot of touring at this point. Like, looking back, it's like kind of makes me dizzy.
The guitars show that.
Oh, they've been good to me.
Yeah.
You know,
you were saying though that you know, you're kind of a late bloomer when it comes to performing and live music, but you were working on good. You were apprenticing for a luthier.
That's right. So I was born in Daytona Beach, Florida.
Okay.
1982.
Okay.
Let's skip forward, like, I don't know, 18 years.
Right? All right.
Well, I mean, like, so I'm, what am I? Like, I'm 37. So I was maybe like 12 or 13 when Nirvana happened, sure. Which is insane that we're here in Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
We totally slammed some Nirvana on the drive into Seattle. Obligatory.
Yeah. Playing a venue.
It changed. I mean, that changed my life because, you know, growing up in, you know, being very young in the 80s,
yeah,
and everything that was hot before it, you know, MTV was starting up and hair metal and, you know, the Poisons and the Van Halens and the Guns N' Roses just never clicked with sure. me. And so seeing Nirvana was like, you know, revelatory. And then seeing Nirvana unplugged was the thing. That was the thing.
Yeah.
And Stone Temple Pilots unplugged. Mm-hmm. Right. And like, seeing acoustic guitars and seeing live performance. Right. Because growing up in Northern Florida, that was a lot of people my age, maybe their first impression of like a live audience and live performance and acoustic instruments.
Oh, for sure.
And stage banter.
Yeah.
And all of those things. And that was like life changing. I did. And the only real outlet, to kind of play with this newfound enthusiasm, for music, ended up being like chorus and musical theater, you know, and music classes.
You had no access to a guitar.
I did, actually.
Oh, you did?
I did. Well, I remember around that time, maybe when I was 11, I said to my dad, I'd like an electric guitar. Mm-hmm. I'd really like to figure out how to make this work. And my dad, you know, my dad worked the same job from 17 until he retired into his 60s. And, as a mechanic on a printing press. He was in the union.
All right.
So he printed the newspaper, the local newspaper.
Sure.
And so, you know, this is like, it's instilled a lot in me, like the importance of labor unions and workers' rights and things sure. like that. But aside from that, just hard work, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I don't have an electric guitar, but I do have a lawnmower and you're welcome to use it anytime you want.
Oh, nice.
Right.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I'll even get you started. I'll buy you, you know, a keg of gas.
Yeah.
And I went around to the neighbors, and for one summer, I mean, in Florida, in northern, you know, Daytona Beach, like Florida. Well, not only does it grow like crazy, we have that thick, what they call like St. Augustine grass.
Yeah.
And you, in the heat of summer, you really need to mow your lawn like at least once a week, possibly twice a week, because it'll get so thick, it'll just kill your, you just stall out.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And so like changing those damn bags before the mulching.
Oh, yeah.
That mowers. I mean, you wouldn't think that mulching mowers and guitars would have much in common, but in this case,
yeah,
it's essential.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah, I mowed it, and I there was a Strings and Things in Daytona Beach, Florida, and I walked in, okay. And this guy Lee Dawson, the store was smaller than this, and there was stuff from the ceiling to the floor, and there was just small little pathways, and it was basically guitars and used appliances. Yeah, kind of like, I wouldn't call it a pawn shop because they didn't pawn. It was
appliances.
Just like, yeah, it was like a, well, I mean, no, it was a music store. I think Lee would just like bring in, like if he had a blender or toaster laying around, he'd bring it in. And
it's got the store.
Yeah, and I took some guitar lessons, and I maybe learned like, I think I learned like maybe a Tom Petty song, you know, and maybe like, you know, like you learn a couple Nirvana songs and you're like, okay, there's a three finger.
Yeah.
Bar chord, or there's a power chord. Okay, that makes sense. You can pretty much put it anywhere because there's no delineation between a major and a minor. You can pretty much do anything, right? And then learned a couple Tom Petty songs, which was like, you know, the basic A shape, C shape, G shape, E minor shape, F shape, right? Yeah. And then it was like kind of off to the races because I never had any sort of patience.
So the lawnmower money did get you a guitar.
Yeah, and what was cool is Lee always said, he told me, he said, now if it was like a Lotus, you know, okay. Lotus like Strat copy.
Sure.
And he said, you know, listen, I'll, as long as you don't mess this up too much and put a bunch of stuff on it, I'll always give you what you paid for it if you want to trade up to the next guitar.
Okay.
He always gave me exactly what I paid for it until eventually I had like a Strat or something.
Wow.
But the funniest thing is there was always, in my grandmother's closet, there was always this guitar that I'm told my Uncle Scott bought. It was possibly in my grandmother's 90s. So her, like, it was quite possibly like World War One or the Spanish American War.
Okay.
Went to Spain and bought a guitar by a maker called Vincent Tate.
Wow.
And it was a beautiful cedar top guitar. It had abalone all the way around the sound hole.
Wow.
And I had no interest in it. I had no interest in it because I wanted an electric guitar.
Okay.
And it's just funny that...
Is it still around?
It is. I still have it. And okay. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, it's a family heirloom and it's precious and
yeah.
It's so appointed. But, and it's, I mean, you can tell that there's like a radius built into the top. You can tell that there's a radius built into the back. I mean, you can hold it and look at it. I mean, the craftsmanship is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And it's just funny that after desperately needing an electric...
You came back to the nylon.
...guitar, I actually started my sort of musical career with a nylon string guitar.
Yeah.
You know, we went to a sauna 2 nights ago.
Okay. Is this an X-rated story?
Well, no, we were at an Airbnb and there was a beautiful like hot tub in the back. And okay. I was like, guys, let's go to the hot tub. They're like, no, we want to go to the sauna. So we went to the sauna and we just ended up sitting in like kind of like human stew. I mean, it's like a hot springs, but there's like 50 people crammed into this pool, right?
Sure.
And it was just like they started like it's in Ashland, Oregon. I think it might have been some sort of
clothing
like
optional.
Leftover Meher Baba like pseudo sex cult thing. And,
yeah, sure.
And I was, this is weird. We got to get out of here. You know, I don't want to like gaze into somebody's eyes, like at first meeting, you know,
sure.
Or I don't want to talk about like, I'm not going to tell you my sign or anything. I mean, I'm into hippie stuff. I'm just not right out of the gate.
Yeah.
So we left and we went back and we discovered that this hot tub at the Airbnb.
Yeah.
Was absolutely perfect. And so that's kind of like, I had to have an electric guitar. Right?
Oh, yeah.
That's a crowded...
Yeah, you took it for granted.
...steamy
Yeah.
Hot tub of mess. And I eventually ended up back with the nylon string guitar that I had all along from birth.
Yeah, you just got to stay in the hot tub.
Yeah, just stay in the hot tub. Just keep hot tubbing.
But how did you were working for a luthier. Tell me that story.
Oh, right. So I guess I had like kind of a bit of like my 20s were rough. My early 20s were rough. Like, not that I was, you know, up against such odds. I mean, I was just like, whatever, weird and sad and, you know, like trying to figure out like what I was going to do with my life. You know, I didn't go to college. That was apparent, you know, that wasn't going to be my path. And so I got a job at a used bookstore and just kind of like just read and then worked at a used bookstore, played guitar a lot. And then I ended up, a woman I was dating, we were, you know, 19 or 20. And she's like, I want to move to Boulder, Colorado. I knew somebody once that lived there.
Okay.
And we were in Daytona Beach, Florida. And we were just like, we had to get out. And, you know, Bush had just gotten reelected.
Yep.
And that was rough. Like being that, I can't even imagine what kids in their early 20s are, how they're feeling now. Like, I feel fortified. Like, I made it through Bush too, you know, and all of that insanity that was. And so I don't know how they're feeling now, but like in the middle of that, like Florida got hit with like five hurricanes in a month. And it was just like the tension was just, you could cut it. And so yeah, we up and moved out to Boulder, Colorado, and I was like walking around and there was a little, you know, take a number kind of thing. It's like, you want to build a guitar?
Oh.
And I was like, yeah, well, that sounds, maybe I'll go check this out, you know. Yeah. And I went up the mountain, there's this crazy old dude and he's got a workshop, and I said, hey, I thought maybe I would, so I want to know what is this all about, like what do I do? And he's like, come back with the six pack and come back tomorrow, and you know. So I just kind of like would keep coming back, and finally he was just like, you know, he took a hit of the bowl and he's like, so what do you want to make?
This is a guy who put a sign up with the tear the phone number.
Yeah, but
his business
not
model
just gonna,
is bring me back some beer.
Well, I mean, listen, he's not just going to take anybody on. I mean, he's a real
process.
Pro.
Okay.
You know, luthiers are, I mean, you've probably talked to more luthiers than
anyone.
I want
to know who this one is.
It's a particular breed of person.
Yeah, and we love you guys.
I mean, we're completely indebted. But there's a certain amount of eccentricity.
Yeah.
A certain amount of just determination, and like nobody does this because they want to work for other people.
Yeah.
Luthiers are a strange breed. They spend a lot of time by themselves.
Sure. A lot of fumes.
A lot of dust.
Yeah.
And so yeah, this guy, his name's Rano. He made mandolins. He made mandolins for like String Cheese and Tony Furtado, and he's a bit like notorious. Uh-huh. He's kind of like disappeared himself from the internet. I think what happened is, like, you know, he made beautiful instruments for very accomplished musicians, and every Trustafarian within, you know, in that jam band scene kind of wanted. And then I think a lot of luthiers in the beginning end up with like a contractor's dilemma, where you have to take on more work to finish old work. You know?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
But anyway, beautiful person, taught me a lot, and was a really good friend to me. And at a time in my life where I really needed one, and what I actually needed was to just occupy my mind with something. I didn't have the confidence to play music, but I could sit there and sand a guitar, and I could learn how to, you know, put on binding or resaw or do frets or learn the basics of inlays. So I made like three guitars over the course of a couple of years. You know, I'd work at the grocery store. It was basically like I bought like a LMII, Luthiers Mercantile. Bought like a kit wizard, you know, I designed my guitar.
Yeah.
And of course I was in my, like, you know, I was like 23 or something. So I thought I could improve upon the guitar.
Yeah.
So of course I made like a 10 string with, you know, a low A and a high A and the D and the G in the middle, were coursed octavely,
of course.
Like a 12 string. Yeah. It was a neat guitar, actually. Yeah. It was kind of like an 8 string guitar, but the D and the G were coursed.
Yeah.
Or you could call it a 10 string guitar, whatever. That was like my long-term project. And, you know, building guitars is hard.
Yeah.
Dovetails are hard. Really hard. Setup is hard. But it was really good for me to like understand a real appreciation for how the instrument is put together.
Yeah.
So I would just kind of work my grocery store job and go in the evenings and just hang out. And
was he charging you? No, you just got to hang out.
Well, we would contribute, you know, it was like, but it was something really like, it was like $200 a month or something like that. And I would get access to the place and also access to his experience, which was, you know, a lot.
Did at any point it feel like, okay, this is my career path, or did it just kind of feel like a surreal dream of you hanging out with this like hippie luthier building stuff?
I learned that I did not want to do that. Also, I'm not really much for like really tight details and numbers and measurements and stuff like that. I'd rather like kind of like freewheel it, you know?
Sure.
But it was an important thing to just learn and develop a deeper appreciation for the instrument itself, mm-hmm. and you know, learn what the difference between, you know, scalloped braces or radius tops, or, you know, like just learn the difference between saddle height and nut height. Because also when learning to, I feel like maybe most repair people, luthier people, have studied guitar making at some point, and that's kind of how they got into repairs, or vice versa. I mean, but it's. You kind of have to know how to build one to fix one, right? And I guess from Boulder, there was a weird thing. There was a breakup, and then there was a crazy period where I was just kind of like flailing, and I ended up in. I took a Greyhound bus from like to Terre Haute to meet a friend that was on a road trip, and I caught a ride to Boston. I was in Boston for like, you know, a month, and I came out to Seattle to try to start a band with a friend of mine who's still a musician. Shenandoah Davis is a piano player. She's fantastic. We tried to start a band and that didn't work. So then I ended up in, like bounced off Florida for a minute.
Okay.
Went to Asheville, North Carolina.
What brought you there?
I don't know. Somebody was driving there and I could get a ride. I was just trying to like figure out what I was going to
do.
And I didn't, I mean, I always knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to do this. I just didn't have the confidence and I hadn't figured out yet how to put a song together. But what was interesting is like, I played in a band in high school. I played bass in a band in high school. And we actually had like some sort of local regional success. Okay. We ended up winning this weird contest the year I graduated high school. Because we uploaded an MP3, we ended up on like TV with like Seven Dust and Eminem and like Snoop Dogg. Yeah, it was really weird. And then like all the label, this is like 1999, so there was like money and all the labels, like this weird like little bidding war ensued, and then the whole thing, and then 9/11 happened.
Oh yeah.
This sort of thing ensued over the course of the next year, and we were trying to get a record deal and we thought it might happen, and then 9/11 happened and just everything stopped.
Yeah.
Like nobody was,
no more free meals.
Right.
Yeah.
So I quit. Anyway, then the Boulder thing that I talked about, and then all that ensued. I just ended up in Asheville and I was there, and I bought that classical.
Mm-hmm.
A little breakup ensued. I caught a ride to New York City. I was living in the basement, the flooded basement.
Mm-hmm.
Made my first demos on a little Panasonic lunchbox.
Yeah.
Tape recorder. Somebody plugged the quarter inch jack into their laptop and made me a MySpace page.
Good.
MySpace. Good old MySpace, man. Miss it.
Yeah.
Miss it.
Those days.
I don't miss any. I have a problem with the internet in general, but.
It was a good time. Little did we know what it would evolve into.
Into the great wide open now, yeah. But started playing gigs around New York.
Mm-hmm.
Started doing some open mics. Started putting some songs together. And eventually I went out with some buddies, like opening their tour. Mm-hmm. I got a booking agent through a gig I was playing, like a small booking agent who later went on to be a big booking agent and dropped me, of course. But it's okay, I recovered. And thanks, Brian. Gosh, I self-released two records.
Yeah.
That was the hardest thing, is figuring out, you know, I had my MySpace demos.
Yeah.
And it's like figuring out how to make a record.
Oh, yeah.
Was really difficult. And like, what do I like? How do I do it? The idea of like folk music to me is just utility. I mean, what, you got a guitar? Okay, cool. Like, I've never really liked really produced records.
Yeah.
Like, the obviously, like, you know, obviously old field recordings, you know, the country blues stuff, mm-hmm. you know, Skip James, Sunhouse, Buka White, Mississippi Fred, you know, Mississippi John, like all the, I mean, that's the greatest.
Yeah.
And it's so simple.
Yeah.
And it doesn't need anything. So my first record was kind of like that. My second record was kind of like that. And I was, my great uncle died and there was like, you know, like $1,000 or something. And, mm-hmm. and I went to Louisville and, I had met this guy, Kevin Ratterman through, Cheyenne Marie Mize, who played in a band. Cheyenne played in a band called Maiden Radio with, Joan Shelley.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so I met Kevin and I went out and we just set up some mics. I made a record. Yeah. And then that just started the process of like, I made a record. I did 100 shows. I came home and
yeah,
I immediately made another one and went out and did probably 200 shows. And then I, at some point, I had sent my second record right before it came out. This is a thing that I've learned. If you make a record, send it out before it comes out.
Okay.
Right, do a little groundwork before the record comes out, right?
All right. Because a lot out there.
Yeah, man, because it's like, you know, you're going to work hard on it. Like, I know you want to just put it out, but like, take a minute, send it to some people, see if they like it.
And
don't just put it out. Like,
yeah.
Take 6 months and set it up. Like, because that 6 months is going to come and go.
Yeah.
Anyway. And so I sent it to, like, I looked and saw who's touring Europe. And I made like a list of like 10 booking agents mm-hmm. in Europe. And I sent the record to all of them. And I said, this record is coming out, next year, like in 6 months, like I'd like to try to tour Europe. Maybe somebody has a band I can, jump on with, you know? And that happened. Like, an agent said, hey, you can do like 3 shows with this band and I can probably get you another 4 or 5 shows. And that was it. I had my ticket, you know? Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't have my ticket. You know, I sold all my John Fahey records, all my uh-huh. LPs that I'd collected to buy that damn ticket. I wish I had those.
Most of it's on Spotify.
Yeah, and that's a shame. It was fun when it wasn't and you had to go. It was really fun when all the Tacoma stuff was not reissued and was not on Spotify. And like, yeah. It was like mythical, almost the way that like, Fahey himself went and sought out these things.
Yeah.
You know?
I don't think so. Maybe the Robbie Basho stuff. I don't know. There's probably still some amazing artists that aren't on there, but.
Absolutely. Yeah. But there was just a nice zone, like pre-YouTube and pre. I mean, it's great that we have access to it, but, you know, I remember finding a copy of Tom Waits' Big Time at like a video VHS rental store. And I was so excited that we went to Walmart and we bought a VHS to DVD recorder, which existed at the time.
Oh yeah.
We dubbed it.
Wow.
Returned it.
Oh yeah.
And then cherished that DVD, got like passed around our circle of budding, Tom Waits aficionados.
Good old dubbing.
Yeah. 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 Jeez. So yeah.
Are you one of those artists that, there are some artists out there where the Europeans just gravitate towards them more so than their hometown.
Oh yeah. That's kind of where I was. So like I found an inn there. And then while I did that first tour, like there was a little bit of sort of chatter, and then a second tour materialized, and then a third tour, and I went to maybe on that second self-released record, I went to Europe maybe like 4 times, and I had befriended Ben Knox Miller from the Low Anthem,
okay,
who had just built a recording studio upstairs of the Columbus Theater in Providence, Rhode Island. So I'd go to Europe, I'd make a little money, I'd come back, and me and Ben would record, and then I'd tour a little bit, and I'd have every time I had a little money to spare, I would just start chipping away at this record.
Yeah.
And you know, eventually Ben got busy, and I took it back to Brooklyn and did some overdubbings, and at this point, I was doing at least 180 shows in those 2 years. I mean, it was a lot of touring.
It's crazy.
And I was about to like do a Kickstarter for this record that I was had just finished, and a friend of mine, Jeffrey, who is how I met Cheyenne and how I met Kevin. That's crazy. My friend Jeffrey, who had a small little boutique PR company in Louisville.
Okay.
He said, "What are you gonna? You should just find a label. Like, who would you want to send it to?" I was like, "I don't know. I could. I mean, I would." Being on Anti Records would be cool, but I mean, that's not going to happen. So he's like, "Well, I know somebody, let me send it to him."
Yeah.
You know, and but he didn't know that I already sent it, and it had been, you know, just like had bounced off them like 2 times already.
Okay.
And it actually took when he sent it, and then I got on.
Who you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they probably never listened to it the first couple times. And there's another note, kids, like be persistent.
Network.
Yeah. Never take no for an answer, because no probably means no, I didn't listen to it.
Yeah.
And it took. And then so that record came out on Anti, and that's when, like, you know, I got to do the Newport Folk Festival. Yeah. I got to do a Tiny Desk concert. Mm-hmm. I got to do some neat things and travel, you know, do the whole big thing again.
I think
between, it wasn't like a calendar year, but there was a time where it was like 250 shows, like between mid 2016 and mid 2017 or something like that, or maybe it was 15 and 16. And so I was just determined to not have to wash dishes or to work at it. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. I mean, some of my best thoughts and lyrics came out of the kitchen.
You listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah. But I mean, well, that was before I knew what a podcast was.
Yes.
But yeah, just kind of like, it's crazy. It's been a crazy journey that I couldn't have planned. And I'm just really lucky to be able to play guitar and get in front of people, you know.
When you're playing that volume of shows, mm-hmm. And you're also kind of early in your career, are mm-hmm. you using the audience reaction to gauge whether a song is good or not? Are the songs evolving, or are you playing 250 shows with like, hey, these are my 12 songs, I hope you like them?
Well, there's more. I mean, there's an increasing catalog to reckon with, which gets harder. I just love to play.
Yeah.
You know? And I can sit on the couch and just play for hours. I mean, songs require a bit more form. I don't know if one can really gauge audience response. Like, if you're feeling it, they're going to feel it. I mean, it's like, it's almost like this unmeasurable, intangible thing. It's not like the volume of applause, because if you play a pumped up track, they're going to hoot and holler more than a beautiful. I mean, sometimes it's a gasp.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's you hear everybody take a breath collectively at a delicate moment or something. Sometimes it's a Tuesday in the middle of Omaha and you wish that there was somebody, anybody there to hear when you just got it right.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, possibly some of the most committed performances that I've, been through.
Yeah.
I've been for like 5 or 6 people.
Yeah. And the in one of the room. Things that I love that you do, and I think a reason a lot of guitarists love what you do is, you know, you're combining the fingerstyle Fahey thing with mm-hmm. these powerful songs. Mm. Was there Fahey training? Did you learn from, did you take lessons from anyone, or was this just like you emulating what you heard on those records you ended up selling?
Well, it's interesting. I don't attribute too much to it. There's a part of my family, like way back, that kind of like split off, but I mean, it's same name, from, you know, the Stelling Banjo.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I know Jimmy, Jeff's, son.
Okay.
He played in a band called the Hackensaw Boys, who I'd done, a number of things with, some shows and stuff over the years. And, you know, there was always this kind of thing growing up where my, you know, my dad would be like, well, you know, like, there's a banjo company, and I did our whatever, familytree.com,
yeah, whatever. Just before 23andMe and all that.
Yeah. And apparently, blah, blah, blah. But I was always just kind of taken by finger picking and the idea, and maybe playing bass in a band with my fingers maybe had something to do with that, like in high school. And when I was working at a bookstore in Daytona before I moved to Colorado, there was a great guitar player that played locally, named Joseph King. He worked at the bookstore as well, and he just kind of, he was like my sort of my local idol.
Okay.
When I was growing up, and he played more of like a, you know, a hard ripping sort of like Stevie Ray Vaughan kind of blues, and Muddy Waters, all that kind of great electric blues. And he kind of heard what I was fiddling with and kind of pointed me in the direction of, like, I had already sort of come to it on my own. And it's really interesting that, like, when somebody does that, when you're kind of like, oh, I'm messing with finger picking, and somebody's like, hey, you should go check out this.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, the lid blows off.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's, you know, Fahey and Kottke and Basho and, you know, even like the Hawaiian slack key.
Mm-hmm.
And then the way that of course ties into country blues. And even like ragtime, I mean, there's a lot of elements of ragtime.
Yeah.
You know, all of the syncopation and just learning to lock in that thumb.
Mm-hmm.
And once it's in, you can pretty much go anywhere.
Yeah.
Polyrhythmically.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, you know, the Mr. Holland's Opus thing where they're banging the kid with the mallet on the helmet.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember just sitting there on the couch, alternating my thumb and tapping my leg with the other, like, if this is the you know, learning not even yet with the index finger.
Yeah.
But just learning how to, like a drummer would learn separation.
Yeah.
You know, that's, for me, that was like it's percussion. So you should treat it as such. Like you have to really drill to learn that flexibility. And at first I came up with some roles on my own, and then I kind of, you know, would listen to stuff. And finger picking is it's very meditative. It's very calming and soothing.
Do the lyrics always come after?
No.
No?
I think anybody will attest to the fact that you never know where it's going to come from.
Yeah.
But a lot of like coming up with maybe a guitar part and kind of improvising and maybe demoing, and maybe some words start to form, and listening back to those things and be like, oh, it sounds like I said this. And then all of a sudden you catch on to something, snags.
Yeah.
And then you just kind of pull that thread, and maybe a song forms. Mm-hmm. And maybe a song takes a storytelling approach. Maybe it takes a, you know, completely surrealistic. I'm not really interested in what I think the songs are about.
Yeah.
There's a song on my previous record called O River.
Okay.
I'm happy with that one. It's really simple. It's actually in part like a song that got me my first tour in Europe, because one of the first gigs we got was at a museum. And that museum had a bunch of sort of paintings they were trying to figure out how to get into a show.
Okay.
And they asked songwriters
yeah.
to write songs. And a buddy of mine was like to write songs about certain paintings. And then they were going to have like a, you know, like sure. iPod and headphones. And
got it.
Right?
Yeah.
And a buddy of mine, Sam Bush in Charlottesville, was actually asked to do, I wasn't asked to do it. He was asked to do it. And he told me about it when I was playing. He runs a little concert series called The Garage in His Charlottesville.
Name is Sam Bush?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay.
Not the mandolin
I know,
player.
But yeah.
But he runs this, a lot of musicians, a lot of touring musicians will know The Garage in Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. It's a little one-car garage of a funeral home.
Okay.
It opens up onto a park.
Okay.
And they set up a little PA and people come and gather in the park and listen to music and pass the hat.
Yeah.
Right. You don't get guarantees at first.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And anyway, like I submitted a song and that was part of me getting that first gig in
okay.
in Europe. But this song, O River, somebody came up to me and said, I always thought it was a song about maybe confronting one's own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the painting I wrote it for, it was a man looking very world-weary, just floating, you know, head hung with a canoe at the shore of a river, looking like he's just gonna, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's over. And but this woman came up to me last night and said that she just like lost it and started, she just like had a really emotional moment when I played that song last night. Yeah. We played at the old church in Portland, which was, it was beautiful.
Yeah.
She said because her son's name is River.
Oh, see? Yeah.
And then I thought about the lyrics and all of a sudden this song that I thought was about mortality
yeah.
became, if the song is like speaking to the river, like, you know, O river, carry me down to the end. With you, I will travel a missive yeah. descend. You know, take me, I have no need for more. And then all of a sudden, the song that I thought was about mortality, through her eyes, was a song about sort of selflessness
mm-hmm.
and putting this child first, right?
Yeah, it's heavy.
So songs are Rorschach tests.
They are.
It doesn't yeah. matter what I think they're about, but I'm incredibly interested in how people
yeah.
might react to them, because then I can save that up and that can be something that I can pull from.
Yeah.
The way that an actor would pull from, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like because you are essentially acting when you're on stage performing a song, you have to get there.
Yeah.
If it's going to come across, it can't just be technical.
Yeah.
You have to like, I at least have to pull from some reservoir of emotion.
Have you thought about acting? Acting?
My first experience with even playing a guitar on stage was playing Will Rogers and Will Rogers Follies in my
right.
Sophomore year of high school,
right.
or maybe it was junior year of high school. Yeah.
All right.
I gravitated towards musical theater.
Yeah.
Because that was what was available.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe if I hung around, they might let me play guitar in something.
Always fall back on it.
Yeah. Yeah, the arts and theater and all that stuff is really important. It saves lives.
Yeah.
You know?
How, you've got a new record coming out in just a couple of months. Ben mm-hmm. Harper produced it.
Wow.
I know you guys go back a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think you guys were on a Newport Folk Fest podcast or something together.
I interviewed Ben for the Newport Folk Festival, but a couple years before that,
yeah.
I made my first record, Labor Against Waste, for Anti, which is when I got to play the Newport Folk and mm-hmm. did the Tiny Desk stuff and all that, right?
Yeah.
That was kind of like a moment for me when that record, because I guess I had been kicking around, you know, and finally there was sure. a label behind it. And a lot of, you know, I think some people that had encountered me were kind of excited for me and gave yeah. me, you know, gave me a little nudge. A friend of everyone at the label, someone who doesn't work at the label, but is friends of everybody. It just so happened had mm-hmm. grown up with Ben. This is before Ben was putting out some stuff on Anti.
Mm-hmm.
And sent Ben my record. And he liked it. And the fella offered to introduce us. And it was just like, you know, a pleasant little email exchange. And I was like, oh, and if you ever need an opener,
mm-hmm.
you could really help me out right now. Because I just played for like 5 people in Austin, Texas last night. I remember where I was when I got the email from him. Yeah. And he took me out and he put me in the Beacon, the Ryman, Massey Hall, the Tennessee Theater. I mean, Massey Hall, man.
Yeah.
Like the Ryman, the Beacon.
Yeah.
After, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of shows just trying to get from point A to point B. And it was just, it worked.
Yeah.
The audiences responded to it.
Did you have to change the way you play and interact when the audience is 100-fold?
No, because they're Ben's fans and they're listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were, it was great. And I immediately, when I found out I was going to be doing that tour, of course, I booked, you know, like a month later, I turned around and did all the same. I just literally repeated the tour in tiny rooms and just tried to pull some people, you know.
Yeah.
My lady and I like passed out flyers at all the Ben shows and tried to get people to come back and see me again because, you know, they get a 30-minute opener set and hopefully we get them. And
did you realize that before the tour?
Yeah.
You did. Wow.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had been doing it.
You're always prepared, you Eagle Scouts.
I'm an Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
I'm always prepared. Preparedness is absolutely, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That
was brilliant.
Don't be looking for a phone charger. Bring your own. Don't be, you know what I mean?
We're going to get to that. We're going to get to the gaffer's tape.
I carry I carry tape, all the stuff. I need stuff.
I want to hear about it. But Ben,
he, God, what a gracious thing. I mean, to put me in those rooms. And, you know, I kind of went on that steam for a minute and I made my most recent, until this next one comes out, itinerant arias in the week in between the Ben tour and me going back out.
Oh, wow.
Right? Because I wanted to keep this thing going. I finally, after, you know, 6 years, I had a little bit of enough momentum that justified doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They tell people that start a small business, like, you know, you got to be able to float it for 2 years. It's going to take a minute for it to catch on.
Yeah.
And so I was just absolutely, I mean, I was on a record label at this point and that it means something.
Sure.
But it doesn't.
It's not.
I mean, they're wonderful and they're wonderful people. It's not night and day,
mm-hmm.
right? It was a culmination of that and all the years previous work. And they did move some mountains, but, you know, I mean, it was all incremental.
Yeah.
Right? And so I had a great time. Me and Ben, I got to get up and play with him. He was wonderful. Watching him play after a 25-year-long career. And watching the way that he commanded and participated with and was grateful for his audience was incredible. And then we kind of, you know, went our ways.
Sure.
And I did the Itinerant Arias record. I carried a band for the first time. I lost a lot of money doing that.
Never again.
I'm not going to say never again.
Yeah.
They're fantastic players.
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
I mean, look, it's like this. It's like, say I go out and make $400 or $500, right? Sometimes a lot less.
Yeah.
Sometimes more. What do you got? Hotels, you know, food. You, say you take 3 people out, right?
Yeah.
I took an upright, a fiddle, and my wife singing with me and playing percussion. Okay. So you got to pay everybody something, mm-hmm. right? What do you say? $100 a day? Is that worth, you know, I mean, people want to go on tour, but like, come on, man, nobody should make less than $100 a day doing a full day's work.
Sure.
They should make more, right?
Yeah.
These are people that have studied music and worked their ass off, but that's the reality. A lot of side people make $75, $150 a day until you get a big gig and then maybe you can get a little bit more. So you got 3 of those, you know, then you got 2 hotel rooms.
Yeah.
So what do we got? $300. 2 hotel rooms, that's another $200. You know, I always felt obligated or obliged. I wanted to buy some meals and I was drinking a lot at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a couple drinks, I'm buying rounds. I learned some lessons, you know. I came home from that tour, got rough.
Yeah.
Because I saw the financial ruin and I was like, well, fuck it. If this is going down in flames, I'm going to feel good.
Yeah.
Went large. Came home from that tour and the touring had caught up to me and I was feeling destructive and my drinking got out of control and, came home, quit drinking on Christmas Day. That must have been 2018.
Okay.
Or something, right? No. Yes, 2018.
Okay.
Christmas Day.
Coming up on a year.
I had no idea what I was going to do. I felt like a failure. I mean, nothing had failed. I just...
Yeah.
I got myself into a situation financially, and I had just toured for a year. Mm-hmm. And fuck, what am I going to do? The tour is over. I got to make another record. I'm fucking broke.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? And on New Year's Day... randomly, I got an email from Ben. I quit drinking for 1 week, but I kind of like threw it up in the air. You know what I mean? I was like, okay, here I go. I'm going to make an effort.
Yeah.
Help me out.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to get all hippy dippy magical thinking. I'm a pragmatist, but also there's something to intention.
Yeah.
And yeah, I got an email from Ben. He said, hey man, like I've been known to try to often do produce at least a record a year besides my own, and if you want to come into the studio, I'd be down. And I freaked out. I didn't respond for a week. I was like, what? I don't have any songs.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm feeling kind of raw. And I had just been offered a songwriting residency. A friend of mine plays in a band called This Frontier Needs Heroes, Brad. He was involved in the Stetson Kennedy Foundation in Jacksonville, Florida. Stetson Kennedy was a civil rights activist.
Okay.
Early. Used to travel and write with like Zora Neale Hurston and was good friends with Woody Guthrie. Mm-hmm. Stetson like infiltrated the KKK. And like posed as a member and then wrote like a giant exposé. This is like in the 30s.
Yeah,
this is in the 30s. Yeah. Yeah. And then like had to run for his life and all this stuff. But Woody Guthrie had finished his second book, not Bound for Glory, but his second book, but used to spend a lot of time. You hear these stories about towards before the disease really set in, mm-hmm. and he was immobilized. Woody would run down to Florida, mm-hmm. and like live in a bus and do all this crazy camping. That bus that he lived in Florida was at this property.
Wow.
At Stetson's house.
Wow.
So they have like my friend Brad with them had started like a songwriter residency, and there was this cool octagon cabin that they had built, Stetson had built, on a swamp.
Alright.
And the stipend, I guess it was like, you know, a couple hundred bucks for some food, and you got to live in this house and write. That was the idea. It was like a week. Mm-hmm. And I asked for two, and they obliged. Mm-hmm. And I went and moved my shit. Not all of my shit, but I brought a bunch of guitars and some notebooks into the house and just kind of fell apart. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I just kind of got in there. I was alone. I had a good cry. I just kind of looked at the past. I hadn't taken a breath. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I was sober. For like, this was in February of 2018.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. What did I say that I quit?
So what, yeah, it's coming up on 2 years.
I don't even know what day it is.
It's all right.
Yeah, 2 years. 2 years on Christmas Day.
Okay.
And I started writing. Mm-hmm. You know, I started writing. I wrote a bunch. I recorded a bunch of, you know, do what I usually do. I recorded a bunch of improvisations. Mm-hmm. I started sketching. That was in February. I guess we thought maybe we were going to record in like September. That became November. That became December. We actually ended up recording the next February. Mm-hmm. I went to Europe a couple times. I did some tours, new sober tours, which was awesome. Mm-hmm. And kind of, you know, worked on some songs. It was great. I kept getting more time. I wrote a lot of songs. Mm-hmm. Maybe like, I don't know, like, there's a lot of bones buried in the backyard. Do you know what I mean? Sure. Bits and pieces. Maybe 30 something. I don't know. 35. Actually, it's exactly 35. And yeah, I sent him the songs. He picked them.
He picked them out of the 35.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
You trusted him enough.
Well, I'm not difficult. That he I'm be difficult trusted. To work with.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Of course he should be. You know, I was like, you know, there was a few that I was like, really? But there was a few I let it go. And really, truly, he picked the songs. And that was like a real process of like learning to trust and let go.
Yeah.
You know, I needed a buddy in this one.
Yeah.
And he showed up, you know.
Where did you record it?
In Los Angeles at Palomino Sound.
Okay.
Small studio run by this guy, Jason Soda. Jason used to play in a band called Everest, and then later I met him actually in like Switzerland. He was playing in a band called Gospel Beach, but we literally were just in the elevator together, said hi, and then pieced it together later. Small little studio. He gave us a great day rate. We went in there and worked, I think, for 8 or 9 days. And, you know, like any recording session, there was moments of just elation and joy and laughter, and there were tough moments that we had to, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
My ego can be just whatever. It's right. Learning to let go, learning to trust. It's the first time I'd ever worked with a producer. Couldn't have picked a better one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was his idea. I mean, I'm glad he did it, and it was a real learning experience. And, gosh, I think it's good.
It is good.
Thanks.
What did he bring to the table besides the song curation? Was he, you know, these are
just a brain.
Yeah.
Right. A real solid musical, historically, mm-hmm. Informed histrionics. You know, he knows music. He grew up in music, you know, his sort of family relationship with the Folk Music Center and everything in Claremont, and his 25-year-long career, and his intuition, and also, you know, he's a presence. He's Ben Harper.
Yeah.
I'm in the studio.
Yeah.
Right? After a couple takes, man, if I'm screwing up, I'm sweating, bro.
Yeah.
But because I always feel like in the studio I'm wasting other people's time. That's a hard thing not to feel like. Everybody's just waiting for you to get it right.
Studios are weird, yeah.
But he was very, in that regard, he was very comforting and very patient. And yeah, it was just kind of a blur.
Yeah.
You know, it was like we just got in there and we worked, you know.
Yeah.
And, like, I remember Steve Albini saying something once, if it takes more than a week to make a record, somebody's doing it wrong.
Yeah.
Not to say there's not something great about getting in there and being meticulous and doing all the things.
Yeah.
Because sometimes I listen to my records and I wish I'd gotten in there and done the little.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never felt that way about anybody else's records.
Yeah.
My favorite moments since.
Yeah.
Like we were talking about Dylan when I got here, and how like the mistakes are my favorite part.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did you bring this Martin?
Yeah, I played the Martin. I played a. I have a. A 28, maybe a 27, L1, mm-hmm. also mahogany.
Mm-hmm.
I played my I have an ES-125. The 28 L1 I should mention I bought for $600 at the North Carolina guitar show.
You still working on guitars? Will you take one apart?
I take all of my guitars to my friend Justin Eisenman in Asheville.
Okay.
Eisenman Guitars. EisenmanGuitars.com. He's a builder and he's a luthier and he's absolutely great.
Mm-hmm.
I've taken him to Jack Dylan,
okay,
as well in Asheville, who a lot of people would probably know. But, you know, Justin's my friend. He's got two young, beautiful children. He's making a go at, mm-hmm. He's a great builder. Works out of his house. And so he just refretted this Martin for me. He's refretted the nylon string that I wore through the frets on.
You're a hard player.
I wore through the I I popped the back off because I knew if I didn't just commit on the Gibson C1 that I usually play, if I didn't just do something drastic to it, I would never get it done. And eventually it would implode.
Okay.
So I took a putty knife, I heated it up, and I popped the back off because I knew it was hide glue and I knew it was brittle and I knew it would just pop off.
What did you heat it with?
Just the oven.
Yeah.
Just on the oven. And I brought it to him. He's like, oh my God. And I was like, yep, now you're going to. So he redid the braces and he's done a lot of work for me. Having a luthier you can trust.
Yeah.
I don't have the time.
No.
I don't have the time. I don't have the bench. I don't have the tools.
Sure.
I know relatively how these things work, but I was so young when I was. I have a, if anything, I cultivated respect.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's something me and Ben probably got on about, is like he has a great reverence and for luthery. You know, he worked in his in his grandparents' shop, and yeah, I think everybody here, if you have old guitars, everybody listening, like if you have old guitars, like it's a, you got to maintain, you got to maintain them. The weather changes and you know, you should probably have a three saddles. You know, a winter, a summer, a transition, right? But at the end of the day, if you treat it like a baby, it'll act like a baby, you know? And if you're too, like, I don't do humidifiers or anything like that. I don't do it.
Yeah.
But I should, but I don't. I mean, if it breaks and you fix it, it's stronger than it was before.
Yeah.
Was there any? All my guitars become, I mean, I've never had a pristine. It becomes a player's guitar pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah.
I will crack it and repair it. And
yeah, that thing. It's amazing.
Yeah, I broke it. I broke it in half once. I kind of did this. Sometimes I'll slap the side of it. Nice. My C1, my Gibson C1 has big, thick sides. Oh. I'd never had a Martin before. So when I got this one, I slapped the side of it and it just, it unzipped.
Can't be slapping the baby.
It unzipped. And yeah, I broke the heel cap off. I've quite a few cracks repaired, but you know, you fix them and they're good as new. If you have a good luthier, you can.
Yeah.
I mean,
for the recording, did Ben have any rare vintage pieces he wanted you to play through, or
man,
you were just like, this is what I play. Don't mess with it. You look troubled. Sorry.
No, I'm not troubled. I'm remembering a guitar. God, I fell in love with this guitar. He brought a, maybe it was a, what's the difference between a 18 and a 28?
The wood, the back, mahogany or rosewood.
Okay, 28 would be a Brazilian.
Yeah, it would be.
Okay,
if it was of a certain.
He brought
area.
A D28. What he said was a pre-war era, right?
Okay.
Because here's the thing: is like just because it wasn't a pre-war guitar doesn't mean it wasn't made from the same wood. There's an overlap. Apparently now, I should really know what I'm talking about on this because they're going to come down on me, right? Your people
know
are going to.
I can even fact
they're
gonna, keep it. Go
they're
going to
swoop in. Apparently, Ben was saying that there's like a pre-war era because if into like maybe 49 or 50, 51, the same as the same wood was, the wood was acquired in a giant cache of wood, and it would have been the same wood anyway. So it was like a, it was like a 50s D28 Brazilian rosewood back and sides. I can't say that I'd ever really played a Brazilian rosewood guitar.
Yeah.
But he busted that out for, there's an instrumental on the record called Bluebed, which I did. It was the last instrumental piece that I played in our little session that we just did.
Yeah.
And I played that.
That's a dreadnought. Wow.
I'd never even played it. I can't say that I'd ever played a proper dreadnought before. Okay. I've just always gravitated towards, you know, after I worked my ass off, I got that Martin and I've gotten a couple nicer guitars, but they've always been, I've always bought them kind of as junk and had to have next reset and get them up to working order. That was a proper guitar and the depth. I mean, just the way it resonates with your body and the way that you just feel it all the way through. And also like not playing with it, standing up. Mm-hmm. And letting the, you know, that interesting thing that happens with guitars where if the back is resting on your chest or on your cavity, like on your abdomen.
Sure.
And then when you open that up and then the whole back starts mm-hmm. overtoning, mm-hmm. right?
Sure, a little space, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a whole different thing. And, yeah, God, that guitar. He brought a Jackson Brown Gibson.
Okay, it's SMEC.
Yeah, the SMEC.
Like a newer one.
Deep.
Yeah.
Deep bodied. I liked it. I didn't play it on the, I didn't end up playing it on the, maybe I did. No, I don't think so. I think maybe it just needed a little saddle, you know, that weird kind of thing when the saddle needs to be crisped up a little.
Got it. Spoken like a true luthier.
Well, you know, like we just get picky, don't we?
Oh yeah. Yeah. At least you're out on the road. There are a lot of guys who are picky and aren't playing 200 shows a year, but yeah.
What is that all about?
I want to hear more about your preparedness as an Eagle Scout. You got the gaffer's tape.
You got
a leather satchel. You don't have to tell us the exact contents of it, but what are your road essentials?
A lot of nail files. You always got to have a Leatherman. You always got to have a screwdriver. Okay. You always got to have backup like chargers for things. I mean, it's just like, there's just nothing worse than needing something and not having it. I always have a toolbox in the van with
food. What kind of food?
Toolbox food? What kind of food do I try to eat?
What kind of food are you?
I really like pho. I really like ramen, especially this time of year. Mm-hmm. Can't eat too much of it. Don't go crazy on the sodium, right?
Yeah, gotta watch that.
Yeah, I really like Thai and Vietnamese food on the road. Seems to be pretty healthy. I really like, got to get a salad in there occasionally. Yeah. Try to avoid the fast food. Mm-hmm. You know, always got to hit the In-N-Out burger when you're pulling into California. It's essential. All
right.
Try to be healthy. Mm-hmm. You know, not drinking is a part of being healthy.
Oh, yeah.
Drink water. A lot of coffee.
Yeah.
Drink water. It's annoying, though, because then you got to pee all the time, and you're trying to get that six-hour drive done.
It's true.
You know? But I don't know, man. I hope somebody will listen to my songs because of this. I mean, it's...
They're fantastic. They better.
Thanks. Yeah, it's really strange that this ended up being my life. And, I hope it keeps being my life. I don't know what else I would do. You know,
yeah.
I see cats that have been doing it for a really long time, and I wonder how like the times that they grew up in are different than the times that we're growing up in. Maybe music like was more marketable, and maybe there was a less crowded sort of marketplace. Yeah. But I've kind of resigned myself to the fact that I should really spend less time worrying about that, and more time worrying about the art and the music. And this will be my last record on my, not my last, I mean, I don't know, but last record on my contract for Anti.
Mm-hmm.
What's next? I don't know.
Yeah.
I've put 10-15 years into this, and no, not that, I mean, since I started, what, I put out my first record in 2012, so
not, but still,
yeah. But yes, a lifetime.
Yeah.
And I'd like to keep doing it. I think there's a value as an audience member that I get from live performances and seeing people do things. And but it is crowded. You know, when you think about it, how many musicians are trying to start a career every day, every year? How many new artists are trying to? And then, but every year it's exponential. How many are trying to maintain beyond that initial debut, right?
Yeah.
But my life will change, you know. I have a dog now. I got my lady. I got my lady. Yeah, she wants to, you know, we'd like to have a family. And
the dog is usually the gateway to the kid.
The dog is a gateway. Yeah. I've never loved anything more than I love this stupid mutt. She's just beautiful.
Mutt?
She's just a mutt. She's a beautiful, like pointer, pit bull. Kind of, you know, black patch on the eye, Ida Mae. Her name's Ida Mae after the Lightning Hopkins song. I love dogs, love guitars.
Okay.
Like books.
Books are good.
Like coffee.
Coffee's good too.
Not as much as I like people.
It's all you need. It was life.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.